So I'll say good morning. My name is Martin Suberg. I'm the commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. This is our monthly call with wastewater operators to talk about operational issues and regulatory issues during the COVID emergency, the ongoing COVID response. I'm joined here today by Kathy Baskin, our assistant commissioner for water, who also runs the Zoom meeting, with my extreme gratitude for her ability to do that. We're also joined by leadership in the wastewater program, Leldon Langley, Mary Beth Chubb, John Murphy, of the chair of our licensing board, is with us. We're also very happy to have Denny Dart from EPA, who's joined us on these calls regularly. And I'll be asking later in our time together both Denny and John might provide any updates they would like to offer to the group. A reminder that the call is being recorded. We will put this recording on our website following its completion as a resource for people. It's in the website where all of our FAQs and other information related to the topics we talk about are. And we will follow through by talking about some of the topics that have been previewed by Mickey Nowak and others, but then also open the floor up for any either email, chat types of questions, or if people want to unmute themselves and ask questions. But we thought we would start today with the topic of vaccines, because we know it's been an area of ongoing interest and discussion for this group, as well as the drinking water operators. I know you're all tracking it closely, and we are very pleased that we have one of our colleagues from the Mass Department of Public Health joining us today to give an update on the Commonwealth's efforts on the vaccine, as well as to answer any questions you have about the vaccines and distribution. So I'd like to welcome Donna Lazorek of the Department of Public Health to say a few words about vaccines, and we very much appreciate your being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. And good morning, everyone. I'm so pleased to be here. You know, after clean water and sanitation, vaccines are the most important public health tool we have, especially during a global pandemic such as the one we're experiencing now. I believe that the reason why I was asked to speak is because there remain questions and concerns about the vaccine. Perhaps you have some yourself, or you're experiencing it from your staff. So I just wanted to give a little bit of background about the vaccine and really hope that you'll ask questions. Please put questions in the chat. You know, I'm happy to provide as much information as I can. I know that most of you are familiar with vaccines. If you went to school in Massachusetts, you were very well vaccinated. And because of the work that you do, I assume that most of you have received tetanus and hepatitis B vaccines, and perhaps you've received flu vaccines. So vaccines is not a new topic, but I know that the coronavirus is a new disease for us, and we have three vaccines now that have been authorized by the FDA to help protect us against coronavirus. There are three vaccines that we have: the Janssen & Janssen, which is a one-dose vaccine that was the most recently authorized vaccine, and then Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, two-dose vaccines that were authorized by the FDA in December. And all these vaccines are safe and effective, and I'm going to tell you why we know that to be true. For one thing, vaccines go through more testing than any other kind of medicine. And the reason for that is because most medicines are given to people who are ill, and it's to cure them or treat them. However, vaccines are given to people to prevent an illness. So they're usually given to healthy people. And we want to make sure that we're not giving anything that's going to harm people. The vaccines go through a lot of testing, like I said, more than any other medicine. And the vaccines, the three COVID vaccines that we have available to us, went through extensive clinical trials in a very short period of time. But they, in each of the vaccines, enlisted between 30 and 40,000 people in their clinical trials, half of whom got vaccine and half didn't. These were blinded studies so that even the people administering the vaccines didn't know who was receiving vaccine and who didn't. And then these groups are compared. They're compared in terms of how well they were protected against COVID vaccine and also in terms of side effects to the vaccine. So it starts with small groups of people get the vaccine, and when it's shown to be safe, the vaccine is given to larger groups and finally into tens of thousands of people. And not all vaccines make it through these clinical trials. There are a lot of safeguards in place so that if a vaccine is shown to or suggests that it has serious side effects that make it not safe to give to people, or if it's shown to be not as effective as we would like it to be, despite the millions of dollars that have gone into their production, development, production, those vaccines will not make it to the public. In the United States, all vaccines go through a process where they're first submitted to the FDA to review all the data from the clinical trials. And if the FDA authorizes it as safe and effective, then the data are looked at by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And they also review the data to make sure it's safe and then give advice to the FDA about whom the vaccine should be administered to and under what circumstances. And in Massachusetts, we have a third safeguard, the Massachusetts COVID-19 Vaccine Safety and Effectiveness Evaluation Task Force that also looks at all the data. And all three of these bodies have determined that the three COVID vaccines that we have available to us now are safe and effective. And I know a question that we get a lot is, how do we know it's safe if it happens so fast? And it's true that these vaccines were developed brought to the public in record time. And part of that is because there was a lot of information known about the technologies that were used to make these vaccines. The two first vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, are messenger RNA vaccines, and that technology has been around for decades. And the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a viral vector vaccine, which is commonly used in other vaccines. Another reason why it was able to happen so quickly is that governments around the world invested millions, if not billions of dollars in its development. And finally, what takes a long time for clinical trials for most vaccines is enrolling volunteers. But in the case of COVID, there were many people wanting to step up and volunteer to be part of these trials. So they were able to enroll these tens of thousands of people in record time. And the fourth reason is the manufacturing of the vaccines happened at the same time as the clinical trials were going on, so that the doses would be ready for distribution if and when the vaccine was authorized by the FDA. Not all vaccines make it through these trials. There were about 400 vaccines in the pipeline at the beginning, and there are still that look like they're, will become available, but most of them did not make it through the different stages of the clinical trial. So there are a lot of safeguards in place to make sure that these vaccines are safe and effective when they come to the public. But the monitoring doesn't stop there. It continues after the vaccines have been released to the public. The primary way that this is done is through the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System that has been in place for decades to monitor vaccines. And providers and people themselves, vaccine recipients themselves, can report side effects or reactions to the vaccine or any reactions that happen after vaccination, whether or not they were associated with the vaccine. And this allows the collection of enough data to be able to identify rare instances that might have not shown up in the initial clinical trials. So it's an ongoing process. Data continues to be collected and looked at, and new information is being released on an ongoing basis about the vaccines. And so far, they've been shown to be remarkably effective, more effective than most of the vaccines that we're used to. For instance, flu vaccine is about 40 to 60% effective in any given flu season. But the COVID vaccines that we have available to us are more than 90% effective in preventing severe illness, hospitalization, and death. And as more data is coming out recently that suggests that the vaccines are also effective in preventing infection, which means that they're also effective in preventing transmission from infected people to others. One of the things that we learned from the trials is that these vaccines, like every other vaccine, has side effects. Serious side effects from vaccines, including the COVID vaccine, are very rare. But it is possible that people have side effects, which are normal, in most cases are normal signs that your body is reacting to the vaccine and building protection. Usually these side effects occur within a day or so of receiving the vaccine. They usually last just a couple of days and then generally go away on their own in a few days. Most common side effects are local reactions at the injection site, some soreness, redness that people experience for a few days. It is possible to have more systemic side effects, including tiredness, headache, muscle and joint pain, chills, nausea and vomiting, and fever. And again, these usually last only a couple of days, although people can, you know, feel pretty sick when this happens. And should people have side effects like this, they should talk to their doctor, and they can take Tylenol or ibuprofen to help mitigate these reactions. It is true that what we're seeing is that people seem to have more side effects after the second dose than after the first dose. So people should be aware of that. The only true contraindications to the vaccine, the only people who should not get COVID vaccine, are people who have had severe allergic reactions, such as anaphylaxis to a previous dose of the vaccine or to any of the ingredients in the vaccine. And people are screened for this before receiving the vaccine. You know, we find ourselves in a situation now where there's a lot more demand for the vaccine than there is vaccine supply, although that is changing. More and more vaccine is coming into the state, and more than 4 million doses of COVID vaccine have been administered in Massachusetts, which is really an remarkable feat when you think about it. It only became available in December, and there's it's just been amazing to see what happens. It hasn't been without its problems and bumps and need to make corrections in the process as the vaccine gets rolled out. But 4 million doses have been administered in Massachusetts. And finally, I just wanna say for folks looking for the vaccine, there are two ways to get vaccine, to get yourself on the list to get vaccine. And one is through mass.gov, you can pre-register with vaccine signup. And this is primarily for vaccination at the Mass vaccination sites. And you can also use VaxFinder at mass.gov to search for appointments at pharmacies, healthcare providers, and other community locations. Really, mass.gov is the best place to go to find out where to get vaccine. And finally, I wanted to say that there's a lot of materials on the mass.gov website. If you go to Trust the Facts, Get the Vax, there's a big campaign in 10 different languages, boat posters, videos, a number of tools that you can use with your colleagues and your employees. So I just wanted to, I know we don't have a lot of time, but I was wanted to open it up to questions, see if there's any questions that people have, or are there any questions in the chat?
Yes, there are. Well, let's see, let me just scroll back and see where we're at. There was one about wastewater monitoring. And I don't know if that's something that you've been following, Donna, but, and there's a, so that one is asking, let's see, as more and more people get vaccinated, will that change the results of the COVID testing done in wastewater?
You know, I don't know the answer to that because I don't know what kinds of tests are used. Once people are vaccinated, they have antibodies. Some of the tests show antibodies if they come from vaccines and others don't. So I'm afraid I can't answer that question. It really depends on what tests they're used, are being used.
Well, Kathy, maybe what we'll do is see if any of the people that are doing, you know, sampling and cooperation, whether it's MWRA or some of the communities, you know, have heard anything about that. Otherwise, what we can do is we can try to connect with our colleagues at you know, the part of DPH that actually works on the procurement of the services to you know, do more broad testing. But I don't know if anybody from you know, some of the communities that's doing this surveillance has any insight into that. You know, my guess is right now at the point we are, it probably is not changing a lot of plans, but that's mm-hmm. only a guess.
It's a great question.
I don't see David Gray from Nantucket on, but he has, he did email me this week to let me know that Nantucket is analyzing for various strains, new strains of the coronavirus RNA. And so, and they are detecting it. Okay. In the Nantucket wastewater, you know, and I don't know if anybody else here, and I might, and maybe David is on by phone and I didn't recognize that.
So it sounds like they're actually testing for parts of the virus itself.
For the RNA.
Yep. The RNA, yep.
Yeah. So in that case, the, you know, vaccination shouldn't affect that except to the point until the point where, you know, we're getting fewer people getting infected because of the vaccine. Yeah.
And the only other question I saw in the chat was a request for additional information from DPH. And we have posted those websites that you mentioned, the VaxFinder, mass.gov, Trust the Facts, Get the Vax. So those are all in the chat.
So if I could just then end by saying, you know, as more people get vaccinated, more people who are hesitant in the beginning are beginning to change their minds. We're seeing that in polls, that more and more people are willing to get the vaccine. And I hope that, you know, you see that in the places that you work as well. And if you have questions, please, my contact is Stephanie, and, you know, please feel free to send questions and, you know, we'll try to get the answers for you. If there's anything we can do to help, we'd like to do that.
Let's just see if there aren't any sort of live questions, you know, that people want to ask
sure.
verbally.
Sure.
We'll give one more opportunity here.
Donna, Mickey Nowak from Mass Water Environment Association.
Hello.
Yep. Thank you for the information. That's a lot of good facts to bring back to the staff. And, you know, I want to encourage all the operators to get vaccinated. It protects the community beyond the person and also the workforce. And the longer it takes for everyone to get vaccinated, the longer restrictions will be there on meeting size or meeting in person or these things. So we have to get past this by getting vaccinated.
Yes, thank you for that, Mickey. And it's true that getting vaccinated yourself protects yourself, but also protects the people that you love that are around you. And then the wider community, your colleagues, your neighbors, and in the community as a whole. So that's an important message. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions for Donna? Not hearing any. Again, I want to remind folks that we have we did put a lot of that information in the chat, and it will be on our website as well. And Donna very generously noted that if you have questions after this, let us know, and we will coordinate with Donna going forward, you know, to get answers to those questions. But it's really helpful to have this information as we move in, you know, and more people are getting into the process of getting vaccinated. So Donna, thank you for spending some time with us this morning, and we appreciate the information you provided and the work that you're doing.
Happy to do it. And thank you all for the work that you're doing.
Thanks right again. Now. So with that, as I noted early on, we're joined not only by senior wastewater staff here in Boston, we are also joined by representatives of each of the regional offices. It's important for us all to hear the same things. And if there are things we're following up on, it's good to get an early start on those things. So we have representatives of our regional offices on this call as well. And we're happy, as always, to have U.S. EPA Region 1 with us. I might ask Denny Dart now if she might take a moment to give us any updates that she'd like to provide from the agency.
Thank you, Commissioner. And thank you, Donna. That was very interesting. Couple things. I know people are always interested in opportunities for training that's online, and there are two trainings coming up. If you go to the top of the chat, you can see that Kathy Baskin posted them. These are both on biosolids, emerging issues around biosolids. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, EPA just published a fact sheet for, it's designed for small operators, but the fourth page of this has a long list of funding sources, grants and loans and things like that that might be available to all sizes of treatment plants. So I'll put that in the chat. And that's all I had to offer today. Any questions?
Great, thank you, Denny. Any questions for Denny? Okay.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you. We're also very fortunate to have John Murphy with us. John, would you like to provide any board updates?
Yes, good morning, Commissioner. Just a brief update. The board continues to meet processing applications. We held an interim meeting last week to process some emergency and reciprocity applications. Our next official board meeting is Wednesday, April 14th. So, things are continuing there. One thing to emphasize is December 31st, 2021 is the end of a renewal period, and the Wastewater Board and Drinking Water Board are going to continue to require the 20 TCHs. There's plenty of training opportunity available. As Denny just stated, in a couple of weeks, there's two free EPA trainings on biosolids. So there's lots of opportunity out there. If anyone's looking for lists of training, please reach out to me. I have a running list. Training approvals, just reach out to me as well. Exam sites are up and running. I believe they're adding a few additional exam sites. So I think we're close to the 12 to 15 range now for sites throughout the state to take the wastewater exam. So that's pretty encouraging too. So that's the update from the board. Thank you.
Thanks. Any questions for John? I don't think there's anything in the chat. And if anybody wants to unmute themselves, if any questions for John? Okay. Well, not hearing any, thanks, John, for that update. There are a few topics I just wanted to touch on before we throw it open to questions that may have come up during the course of this discussion, or things that are on your mind that didn't get transmitted to us before this meeting. First, we are still tracking closely what's going on with some of the financial aid that's come through various pieces of legislation, both the COVID relief bills and other bills that were done at the end of 2020, and the more recent COVID bill relief bill done in 2021. As you know, there are funds there. In, I think there were funds initially added in 2020 to for a utility relief type of program. It would basically provide relief for low-income households who are having trouble paying their water and wastewater utility bills, providing support for that. There was initially $638 million provided. I believe more was even added in the more recent stimulus bill that passed in 2021. I do not believe the funding has yet arrived in Massachusetts. We are staying in close touch with our budget office and the Department of Housing and Community Development, who might be the likely recipient and distributor of that funding. Again, we're still waiting to see how the federal government administers it, but this type of program is like other, fuel assistance programs that our colleagues at Housing and Community Development have distributed. We're waiting to see what Massachusetts share is. We're also waiting to see more specifics on the criteria, what utilities will have to do to participate in that program. And we will make it a point to keep you posted on anything we learn. I know some folks in your community, like Jen Peterson from Mass Waterworks, is endeavored to stay in close touch with federal and state authorities. I believe she has some meetings coming up with people in DHCD in the near future to make sure that we're keeping all lines of communication open. I know Jen sometimes joins us on this call. I don't know, Jen, if you're on this one, or Mickey, if you're on, any updates you have from your perspective. Hi, Jen, let's start with you.
Thanks, Commissioner. So yes, we are monitoring this closely, and Josh Schimmel, who's obviously active in the wastewater community, has been working a lot with me on this. So the rate relief piece, we understand that there was still some question about federal guidance on that. I myself have been in touch with ANF because we've had some concerns about some of the latest relief money, sort of the bigger pot of money and the ability to spend it on water and sewer infrastructure, but it's going to the municipality. And so we've had some concerns by districts, authorities, commissions that they may not have access to that money. So I have reached out to ANF on that to see if they could interface with their federal partners and try and get some clarity on how independent utilities might be able to access some of those funds. So we do have a meeting coming up with Secretary Keneally on April 21st, and just hope to have more conversations with him about the rollout of the funds in Massachusetts. But again, a lot of it seems to hinge on federal guidance. So that's where we're at with that.
Great, thanks, Jen. And thanks, Mickey, Mike. Anything you want? Yep, and anything you want to add, Mickey, from or anybody else that might be engaging with either the federal or other people that have some say in how this money gets, how and when this money gets distributed.
Just from our perspective, is this money becomes available, everyone just wants to know what the rules are ahead of time. If it'll be through traditional funding sources, or will there be new categories of funding?
Yep. No, we'll definitely stay in touch while, we understand it's important, and we've been conveying throughout that, working with our secretariat, who in turn engages with other secretariats. So we'll all stay in touch. Sometimes you might hear things before we do. Sometimes we might hear things before you do. So we'll try to make sure that we're sharing information. We're also watching. I know there have been some questions. The new infrastructure bill in Congress has a lot of money for that would potentially benefit water and wastewater infrastructure, significant investments in lead service line upgrades, general upgrading of water, wastewater, and stormwater systems, money to address PFAS types of issues. So we will be working, to make sure that we're aware of the latest developments on that. So with that, I think that's pretty much all the sort of the updates and new news that we have. I might open it up now to see if we're getting any questions either through the chat or if anybody wants to unmute themselves and ask a question or make a comment while we're all here. Okay, give it another second here in case somebody's having a hard time getting the mute button unmuted, which is an experience I have regularly. Okay, we got one in the chat here. The question was posed, could DEP provide an update on the status of DEP getting back to in-person inspections and processing permits that may require staff access to the office? Really good question. In terms of access to the office, we have been operating under a protocol where we're going in on a regular basis to get the mail, to put it colloquially. In other words, those things that come in paper that we can receive them, distribute them, whether electronically or in person to other people, so that people wherever they're currently working, and we are currently, most of us still working remotely, and we will continue to employ that protocol. We're going to continue to follow the guidance, the health-based guidance and the general personnel rules of the administration to make sure that we are maintaining appropriate safety protocols, both for the safety of our workforce and the people we deal with. We are working to, we are going to continue to do that. If it gets easier to have more people in a place at one time, we will certainly start engaging and start letting folks know that. On inspections, we have been trying to get back to some more levels of activity because we recognize inspections are not only important for the work we do in compliance and enforcement, but it's also important for things if people have permits that, permit applications that need inspections or other issues where an inspection is important. My advice would be we are trying to get, if you have a request, we're trying to make sure that we are following all appropriate protocols. So we will be, you will be hearing from us in terms of doing inspections. First of all, though, we will have protocols in place. It's still the type of thing where the inspector needs to talk to the supervisor and we need to coordinate to make sure that we have the safeguards in place. For some of you that have received inspections from us, we'll call in advance and ask you know, how many people are going to be at the facility? What kinds of safeguards do you have? Do you have anybody that's been ill? Would you let us know if somebody's ill on the day we're supposed to show up? Do we have ways to maintain social distancing while we're there? So we are doing that, and we are trying to ramp up. But again, it's we're being very, very cautious about it. So this, I have no doubt, will continue to evolve over the next couple of months as the health guidance changes. But you know, we are trying to get into the business of seeing facilities. If there are alternatives, we can employ. We have had a little bit of success. Not everything works with a virtual inspection, but some things do. We tried to use that. In other cases, like I say, where it is an in-person inspection, we have protocols that will be followed, but people can go out and do those. So we'll be continuing to follow that protocol. And as we modify it, we'll let you know both on these calls and also just through our usual means of communication. But, you know, we're still likely to be remote, you know, into the summer. You know, I think the last guidance we got was into June. And again, that's where we are right now. You know, we will continue to follow the best guidance we can, you know, we can employ, and you know, we'll just make sure that we're considering the best medical information. I saw two questions that came in during the chat while I was talking. One is probably more for the members here, which is there's currently a bill that is to get 3 years added to retirement. Well, I see, it's for state employees. Has anyone been advocating to get municipal operators included in this bill? We've heard about the bill. As you know, our administration typically does not take positions on pending legislation. I'm aware that the bill has been filed. I don't know anything more about it. So if anybody has been spending time, talking to Beacon Hill about, you know, various types of retirement bills, like I said, it might be a discussion that you amongst yourselves might want to be having.
I'll mention something about that bill. There's actually two. There's one in the Senate and one in the House. And yes, they are only state employees at this point, not municipal employees. And I did have one conversation with a state senator. She was surprised that wastewater personnel were even in the bill, affected by the bill. And I mentioned that there's state wastewater operators that work for the correction systems. Certainly they would be in the bill as essential workers. And of course that begs the other question, why not the municipal workers? So yes, we encourage people to write to their House member and, let their voices be known on this. But I think this is the beginning of the conversation, not the end.
Can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
Mickey, I thought the bill specifically called out political subdivisions of the Commonwealth.
As I understand it, it wouldn't be municipalities.
Okay. That's...
Yeah, I'd have to get back to you on that, but my understanding of it was only state workers.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
If I might, I also was under the impression that political subdivisions meant municipalities. I had found a definition in some other statute where that was the case. So I do think we need to do a little bit more work on that, because it was my understanding that our folks would be included in that. So Mickey, you and I can circle back offline.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Terrific. All right. And then we got a question about the CSO notification law. Somebody asked about the status of that. And generally speaking, as you know, we have about a year to get regulations in place at the most, under the terms of the law, the year starting in January of 2020. We have, which means that it's in the near future, you would be seeing draft rules that everyone will be able to comment on. In the meantime, I think Kathy Baskin and particularly Leldon Langley have been spending time starting discussions with stakeholders to make sure that we're getting the perspective on your issues. I believe we had a meeting last week, I think, or actually Monday. I think there was a stakeholder meeting on Monday. Kathy, Leldon, any updates you want to provide?
So we had it was great to have Jeff attend that meeting. Jeff had asked the question, but I think for the benefit of the broader audience. So we had a meeting with dischargers on Monday. We have a meeting with the environmental advocates who pushed for the legislation on Friday. And then we have a meeting with a broader stakeholder committee with representation from dischargers, environmental advocates, paddlers, and the environmental justice population on Monday to get everyone's perspectives and some clarification and issues where they think there is confusion in the language of the statute, where things need to be clarified, what's realistic, what the intent was. So we're looking forward to everyone's perspectives. And then we are planning on later in the spring developing draft regulations because they will need to, we need to start that process. And while those are moving, we'll be working again closely with the advocates and the dischargers on actual implementation. What will the websites look like? What kind of forms are we looking for? Will there be metering or modeling or monitoring? The logistics will be hammered out while the regulations are moving. So looking forward to everyone's input.
And one of the things we'll commit to do is, there, as you've heard, several opportunities for input here over the next couple of months. And we will make it a point to stay in touch with all of our usual means of communication. There is a website link right now. If you put CSO into the search bar, it will come up. It's pretty thin right now. It's just got the legislation and the link to the signing event, but we're looking to give that website a little more prominence and put some meat on the bones as we start moving forward with the development of the rules.
I want to mention something on that. I don't know if the if one of the stakeholders, if the EPA is in on these meetings. The reason I mention that is that plants with new permits might have 2-hour notification from in their NPDES permit. And then some with older permits won't. But I would imagine in the future that 2-hour notification will be in all NPDES permits. So could the federal regulations somewhat align with the state regulations? If there's any major issues or things like that, I guess this is the time to sort them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see Denny posted one resource in the chat. And generally speaking, I think, EPA is aware of this new legislation. And yeah, we will, continue to engage with them. We're proceeding on separate, statutory tracks, but hopefully the practices will align and working with Region 1, we'll do our best to do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, not hearing anything. As we've noted throughout this call, there's lots of things for us to be working on and working together on. We will certainly make sure that we are staying in communication on the COVID and the non-COVID materials. Certainly, we plan to have this call again. Is it going to be May 5th? Will we do this next call, Kathy? We'll plan to meet at this usual hour. If there are developments in the meantime, we will be staying in touch with all of you through our various means of communication. Again, there's some ongoing activity with the CSO work that we're doing and stakeholder discussion. So we look forward to engaging with you. And once again, as we said on so many of these calls, thank you for the important work you're doing to protect the public health of our communities, even in these very difficult COVID times. And we look forward to continuing to engage with you. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.